I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. It's post time again. Odds makers have made Kentucky Derby winner California Chrome the heavy favorite to win the Preakness at Pimlico tomorrow. Chrome might have California in his name, but he has Maryland in his blood. We'll draw Chrome's family tree for you today. We'll also hear about Maryland's horse breeding revival. In fact, revival might be the theme of today's show. Its founder, Barbara Shapiro, tells us about the revival of an arts festival at Druid Hill Park. Best-selling novelist Steve Berry comes to town for the reopening of the Edgar Allan Poe House. And film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed surveys 60 years of Godzilla, from the original to the reboot in release this week. Midday Friday starts after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Coming up in today's second hour, it's all about the Preakness. The 139th running of the middle leg of Thoroughbred Racing's Triple Crown takes place tomorrow at Pimlico. Kentucky Derby winner California Chrome has been made the heavy favorite to win the race. But one of the top handicappers in the country, Andrew Beyer of the Washington Post, says Chrome's slow time in the Derby 2 weeks ago makes projecting a Preakness winner a real challenge. Andy Beyer will be joining us toward the end of today's midday to size up the field and suggest a good bet for you. Between now and then, we'll climb down California Chrome's family tree to get to its Maryland roots, and we'll hear about things in revival, Maryland's horse breeding industry for one thing, an outdoor arts festival in Baltimore's Druid Hill Park for another, and midday film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed joins us today to talk about the revival of the Godzilla movie franchise. Up front, we start with another revival story, the reopening of the Edgar Allan Poe House in Baltimore. Poe lived here for a time. He died in Baltimore in 1849. His house in West Baltimore is a national landmark that used to be open to the public. It closed in 2012 after the loss of funding by the city. Coming up on May 22nd, the internationally bestseller novelist Steve Berry will be in Baltimore to raise money for the Poe House. Steve Berry has written 9 novels, mostly revolving around a signature protagonist, Cotton Malone. Steve Berry's writing is noted for combining history with page-turning suspense. His latest book is The Lincoln Myth. It's a mystery that involves secrets about Abraham Lincoln and the U.S. Constitution. Since history lies at the center of all of Berry's work, he's become deeply committed to preserving the country's historic sites like the Poe House. With his wife, Elizabeth, Steve Berry created the foundation History Matters, which holds fundraisers across the country. I spoke to Steve Berry recently about the Poe House, historic preservation, and about being a writer. Steve Berry, welcome to Midday on WYPR in Baltimore. It's a pleasure to get you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
This is a big event, a big month for you, actually. You have another novel coming out, and you're coming to Baltimore to help with the Edgar Allan Poe House here, which has had some tough times. It was closed for a while. It's going to be reopening. So thank you for doing that. I have a question for you about Edgar Allan Poe. I'm curious how you'd answer this question. What kind of novels or short stories do you think Poe would be writing today?
I don't know. Probably more in the Stephen King type of thing. I think he would be drawn to those kinds of stories that had a grounded in reality type of story that still does has that little extra hook to it, that little extra something to it. So I think he'd be in that genre. I think he'd be very popular in that genre.
Very good. Thank you for that. Exactly. When you were growing up, what did you read? What did you enjoy as far as fiction goes?
I was a historical fiction guy. James Michener was my favorite writer.
Ah.
And I loved Michener. He was my hero. I have a complete collection of Michener books. I've collected them for 40 years. And so I cut my teeth on Hardy Boys, and then I moved to James Michener.
And did you not get to write about James Michener for a re-release of some of his novels?
I guess. It was a great honor. Random House asked me to do the introduction to the re-release of all his novels. They're putting them out in a new format, and I wrote the introduction. And I never thought in a million years that my name and his name would be on the same cover of a book. So it was just a tremendous honor.
Tell us about the new novel, would you, Steve? The Lincoln Myth.
It's Cotton Malone's 10th adventure. He's heading out something very interesting that deals with the Constitution and the question of secession, of whether a state can leave the Union. He also gets hooked up with the Mormon Church, which has a connection to Abraham Lincoln, an actual, real, historical connection, one that altered the course of the Civil War. And Cotton gets caught up in all of that in a very interesting adventure that takes him across the globe, but he ends up back here at home and dealing with all that.
That sounds terrific. So you must spend a lot of time reading historic works, books of history, and looking for maybe, some aspect of historic events that hasn't been told very well or hasn't been told much at all?
That's exactly what I'm looking for. And about 2 years ago, I came across this concept. I learned that Abraham Lincoln was the very first president to ever read the Book of Mormon. And we know that because he checked it out of the Library of Congress in July of 1862. And then in January of 1863, Lincoln made a secret deal with Brigham Young, the head of the Mormons in Utah, that altered the course of the Civil War. And I'm not making any of that up. All that is true. It actually did happen. And when I came across that, that's a little nugget that you know nothing about. But I wanted to know more about it, so I wove this novel around all of that.
Wow. Tell me about this. You and your wife, your wife's name is Elizabeth, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. You both have an interest in history, and it led to the establishment of History Matters. I think our listeners would be interested in knowing this about you, Steve. What is History Matters?
It's a foundation we created 5 years ago to help communities raise money, and that's one reason, part of that's why we're coming to Baltimore. The Poe House contacted us and said, would we be willing to come up and help them out? And we said, of course. And so we're coming in on May 22nd, and we're going to be doing a big gala that evening. And all of the money raised that night will be going to the Poe House. There'll be books for sale. I'll be doing a talk and meet and greet, answering questions, all kinds of things. This is part of what we do. We do these types of events, but we also do a writer's workshop where we teach the craft of writing. And you buy your way in with a contribution that also would go to a project that we are in town to promote. We've done around 75 of these projects. We've raised around $750,000. We've taught about 2,500 students across the country. So it's working. We've had a great impact on quite a few and a varied historical sites. We've done documents, cemeteries, buildings, museums, old houses, you name it. We've helped raise money to preserve it.
Well, I think that's great. A lot of us are concerned here in Baltimore about the future of the Edgar Allan Poe House. The master of the macabre, of course, lived there for a time. He died in Baltimore. His death the cause of his death has always been the subject of much speculation over the years and mystery, which, of course, is appropriate to Poe. But, you know, he may have only died here, but he did live here for a while. There's a piece of Edgar Allan Poe in Baltimore, and I'm happy to see you doing your part to step up to help us preserve it. The H.L. Mencken House is another house in Baltimore that, could use some love. And we have other sites like that in our city. It's hard to press this sometimes when your people are pressed for money, funds to keep these things going. It's a tough sell sometimes.
It's hard. It's almost impossible, sir. And we tell people all the time that historic preservation begins locally. If you're waiting for someone to come in and save you and do it for you, it's never going to happen. And part of the mission of History Matters is that we teach that and we impress that. And we try to leave that impression that, you know, historic preservation is a local matter. And you've got to take care of your own stuff in your own community because no one else is going to do it for you.
Hey, well, I am curious about the rhythm of your writing because you're a pretty prolific writer. A new novel this month, The Lincoln Myth. So I assume you finished writing that some time ago. About a year ago. So how have you spent the last year?
I wrote the book that will come out in 2015. You stay a year ahead in the book business.
Right.
So I just turned in 2015's book. I'm now writing the book that will come out in 2016, which I'll turn in a year from now.
Keep going.
So I stay on that one a year schedule, and I'm 1 year ahead of the reader.
Well, Steve Berry, thank you very much for this time. Again, Steve's new novel, The Lincoln Myth, and he'll be in Baltimore May 22nd to help with this fundraiser for the Edgar Allan Poe House.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And that event will take place at Baltimore's B&O Railroad Museum, and tickets to it are still available. For additional information about the event to help the Poe House, learn more about it, go to poinbaltimore.org or check out my Facebook page. The Dan Roderick's Facebook page has a link to the event and to Steve Berry's website. Now, here's another story of revival, the revival of an outdoors arts festival in Druid Hill Park. Such festivals used to be held around the park's reservoir back in the 50s and 60s. A couple of years ago, Barbara Shapiro, a retired educator who lives in the city, got the idea to bring the festival back. The result was last year's Art Outside, and the revival continues this Sunday. So we want to tell you about it. Barbara Shapiro, welcome to Midday. Nice to have you on the show with us.
Nice to be here with you, Dan.
Yeah, I was interested about these festivals in the 50s and 60s, and I saw a couple of photographs. Can you describe what went on there?
I was there.
Yeah, please tell us about it.
It was started by Amelie Rothschild, a local artist, and she co-opted or engaged a lot of other local artists who've become somewhat famous for Baltimore artists. Herman Merrill, Betty Cook, Joe Shepard, and others were in the art show. And it drew thousands and thousands
of
people.
To the reservoir,
the exact same place where we're having it. It's interesting because it was in the 50s and 60s, and I believe the first show was on May 15th, and ours is on May 18th.
Wow. So you brought it back last year. You were thinking, what were you thinking a couple of years ago when this started?
Well, the first thing was that I, by accident, Googled that the reservoir was 150 years old in 2013. And I thought, that's something that we should celebrate. And there was rumor that they're going to close the reservoir. So I went around and asked a lot of people, as I usually do, what do you think of this idea? What do you think? And everybody said it's a great idea. Now, I think they think that it was a great idea because a lot of the people I asked had been, like me, there as a child. And your childhood memories are usually very happy ones. So I engaged a group of people to help me run this because I'm not a logistics manager, so I didn't want to do Johnny's on the spot and get permits and rent tents and all this other stuff.
So you got some help.
I got some help, some professional help. There are very few volunteers involved in this because, you know, if you ever heard the saying, you know what a camel is? It's a horse that's designed by a committee. So I really got these girls, tried to convince them of my idea, and we from there, that's where we went.
So this is what it looks like. The reservoir, obviously, and the driveway all the way around it, and the fence all the way around it, and artists line up all the way around, maybe not all the way around, but a good portion of the reservoir?
Well, we had 40 artists last year.
Excellent.
We have 85 this year.
That's excellent.
We have 7 food trucks that are going to be there.
An art truck. I heard you have
art truck by a darling young man whose name is Sean Theron, who had an idea and drives around with this art he makes. And this is his first showing of his art truck.
And he doesn't serve soup with it.
He doesn't serve soup. We have soup trucks too.
All right. So this is happening on Sunday. Is free and open to the public?
Free. Everything is free except what you purchase. No admission and no parking fee. And we expect to have, if it's a beautiful day, a big crowd. Some of the features are the Ivy Bookstore is going to have a tent selling Maryland books about Maryland art, etc., and every half hour one of the authors is going to speak. And then we have a distinguished artist tent where we're showing work by Grace Hartigan, by Betty Cook, by others. In fact, I had an interesting experience with a tin can artist who I had never heard of. So it's going to be very interesting.
So people who just like to look at art or maybe in the market to buy art, this is for them. Art Outside at Druid Hill Park on Sunday. What time does it start, Barbara?
11. 11 to 5.
11 to 5 at Druid Hill Park, just around the reservoir.
And we're going to have music by Orchids and by City Neighbor Schools. We're going to have a walk-around artist. It's an exciting day for everybody.
Well, congratulations to you for getting this started again. Now in its second year, Art Outside all day, well, not all day Sunday, 11 to 5 at Druid Hill Park. And you can find more information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. It's a nice day. Get out there. All right, Barbara, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. I hope you come.
All right. I'll be there.
Okay.
Well, I think I'll be there. What am I doing Sunday? I got to check the schedule at home. You know how that is.
I understand.
All right. We'll continue our conversation here on Midday Friday in just a moment. But first, we need to take a quick break here to talk about our spring membership campaign. This is our final day. And Andy Beanstalk's here in the studio to tell you how to show your support. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. Joining me now in Studio A is Midday on Film contributor Christopher Llewellyn Reed, the chair of the Film and Video Department at Stevenson University, who joins us now and then to review films and talk about movies with Linda DeLibero. Today, Godzilla, the famed monster, is back. He's 60 years old, but he hasn't lost a step, really. The monster seems just as able to destroy tall buildings with a single stomp as he did years ago. So we're going to hear about the new Godzilla movie a little bit later with Chris. But up front, Chris, first of all, hello. How you doing?
Hi, Dan. Nice. I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
I'm eager to talk to you about Godzilla, but you got a couple other films you wanted to talk about first that are out this week, right?
Yes, absolutely.
We've got a historical fiction entitled Belle, and a new baseball movie called Million Dollar Arm that I know has John Hamm in it. I don't know much about Belle at all. I haven't even had a chance to book up on this. So let's start with that one.
Absolutely. So Belle actually is, I think, the best film to see in Baltimore this weekend.
Really?
And it's playing at the Charles. And if you're a fan of the novels of Jane Austen or the film adaptations of those novels, chances are you'll enjoy Belle. It's set in the late 18th century, so, you know, Jane Austen time. And it's directed by an actress turned director by the name of Amma Asante, and written by a doctor-turned-screenwriter named Misan Sage, two British women of color, who've put on screen the story of a real woman of the late 18th century by the name of Dido Elizabeth Bell, who was the daughter of a British nobleman and ship captain, Sir John Lindsay, and a captured or freed African slave that he sort of found on a Spanish ship that he defeated. And they had a daughter, and then he claimed this daughter as his own, and she ended up being raised at the home, at mansion, estate of his uncle, the Lord Chief Justice of all of England, Lord Mansfield. And so she was raised as sort of an equal to her cousin, who was also being raised in the same household. And this film tells that story. Not a lot is known of this real woman's life. So there's a lot of license to invent facts and really mold it in the shape of a Jane Austen story, which is what she's done. If you think Persuasion meets Mansfield Park with a little bit of Emma thrown in, and you'll have...
I know some folks who would like this.
Yeah.
By the way, the first name, did you say Dido?
Yeah, Dido Elizabeth Bell.
How is it spelled? Just
D-I-D-O.
Huh.
And that is her that's the name of the historical record. And not much is known other than that she appeared in a late 18th century portrait of her and her cousin, Elizabeth. Her cousin's also named Elizabeth. And the screenwriter saw this portrait in the 1990s. She was a medical student in Scotland and came across this painting in an estate that had belonged to the Mansfield family and wondered, who is this, woman of African descent who's in this painting on an almost equal footing with this white noblewoman? So years later, when she became a screenwriter, she was still thinking of this painting, and she started doing some research and discovered as much as she could of Dido Elizabeth Bell's story, and then, had some screenplays that were turned into movies, so started to develop connections and wrote the script, and it's been turned into really a wonderful, at times formalistic, and at times perhaps there's too much exposition telling you how you're supposed to feel, but overall it's a rousing narrative success, which deals with issues of race, class, and gender in the late 18th century with a 21st century sensibility. But it gives the main character agency and dignity. And if perhaps it's slightly unrealistic that a woman of the time, particularly a woman of color of the time, would have had the freedom that this main character has, nevertheless, we can perhaps forgive the screenwriter and director because the film is so narratively successful.
Wow. It sounds like they reached in and found a great little nugget of history or about a great story. The premise is terrific, it sounds like, for dealing with all those things or addressing social class, for instance.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it turns out that Lord Mansfield, the Lord Chief Justice of England, was responsible for some court decisions that paved the way for the abolition of slavery in England in 1833. So the film posits that the fact that he had this woman that he raised, who was his niece, and that he raised effectively as his own daughter, the fact that she was in his household had an influence on his thinking and in the decisions he made. So whether that's true or not, and certainly if he was raising her as his daughter, we can believe that. But that's the point of view of the film. And he's played in the film by the wonderful Tom Wilkinson, and his wife is Emily Watson, and both of them are great, as is the actress playing the main character, Belle, an unknown really in the States by the name of Gugu Mbatha-Raw. But she's, she's been acting in England since she was a child, and she's well known over there for many roles on TV.
Can we listen to a little piece of it?
Absolutely. So in this scene that I've chosen, she's speaking to Sam Reed, Mr. Duvinier is the name of the character he plays, who's a pastor's son. And here's where the class issue comes into the film, because he's not of the same social standing as her family. Even though he's white, her family doesn't think that he would be a good suitor for her. But she now has
because he's a cleric's son.
He's a cleric's son, mm-hmm. and they're nobility. Mm-hmm. But he's in love with her, and she's falling in love with him. And in this scene, they're walking down a street and talking about how she has money because her father, now deceased, made her an heiress. And so in some sense, she's a great catch, except that she's half African. So they're discussing issues of gender, class, and race in this scene. It's very interesting.
Elizabeth said something when we arrived in London. We women are but the property of gentlemen. But it came into my head that I have been blessed with freedom twice over, as a Negro and as a woman.
I suppose you have.
Or have I? Must not a lady marry, even if she is financially secure? Well, who is she without a husband of consequence? It seems silly, like a free Negro who begs for a master.
Well, unless she marries her equal, her true equal, a man who respects her.
Now, this cleric's son is a bit of a firebrand. He wants to be a jurist, a lawyer, and he is a vehement abolitionist. And so he keeps on arguing his case in front of her adoptive father, the Lord Mansfield. And, he's in love with her
really interesting.
And pursues her.
Because of the racial aspect and the slavery background, it's a bit incongruous, right?
It is an interesting
twist.
To hear
her speaking this way, talking in Jane Austen sort of parlance, a husband of consequence.
Exactly. It does sound just like lines from a Jane Austen novel. Now, she has been raised as more or less an equal in the Mansfield home, except for the fact that when guests are in attendance for dinner, she's not allowed to sit at the table because the Mansfields feel as if that would be pushing it a little bit too much. After all, slavery still exists in England in the late 18th century. So she's an equal, but she's not an equal, and it makes for a very interesting story.
Well, I guess so. Thank you for this recommendation, Chris. And it's at the Charles.
It's at the Charles this weekend.
Chris Reed is speaking here of a film called Belle, B-E-L-L-E. The other movie we want to talk about, baseball film, Million Dollar Arm, also based on fact, right?
Indeed, yes. It's based on a true story. I think the events took place in 2007, 2008. And John Hamm plays J.B. Bernstein, a sports agent who sort of pulled a Jerry Maguire a few years prior to the film. He struck out on his own with his partner, leaving a big agency. And things were going well until they stopped going so well. And the big agency he used to work for has been stealing clients. So he's a bit desperate. And he comes up with the idea to go to India to hold a contest where they would offer money to young athletes, whoever has the fastest and most accurate pitching arm, offer this prize money, and then bring the top two finishers back to the States for a major league tryout. Because India, unlike other countries, has yet to produce a major American sports star. You know, there's Yao Ming in the basketball league, plenty of Korean and Japanese baseball players. So he thinks it's an untapped market, and he's going to represent them.
A very big market.
It's a very big market.
So what's the sound we have from the film?
So here is John Hamm pitching the idea to his backer, Mr. Chang, who's going to hopefully provide the money for this venture.
We can deliver to Major League Baseball its first Indian ball player. That's a billion new fans. What do a billion new fans need? A billion hats, a billion T-shirts.
And you want to set this up like it's a talent contest.
Exactly. That will ensure maximum exposure of talent to press. See, once we go over there and find these guys, we bring them back here, we train them in L.A., then we get them signed with a professional franchise.
What's your timeline?
2 years.
Can you do it in one?
Sure.
Can you do it in a year? Sure. Is he going to recruit among cricket players?
Well, that's his idea. It turns out that the two young men who take first and second spots actually hate cricket, and that's a kind of little funny twist in the film. He thought he was going to go to a nation of cricket players and it would be a good match, but the two guys who win hate cricket and are actually much more interested in baseball.
Did you know anything about this before you
no, not
saw
at all.
This film coming? Okay, no, I knew no. nothing about it either.
Yeah.
What a great story,
it
actually.
Is. Now, the problem for me is that it's a film that does traffic in a lot of ethnic and cultural stereotypes. Ha, 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 look at this, you know, third world country and how silly they are and how you have to, you know, go around the system with bribes. And if you can overlook that and, you know, perhaps you can, perhaps you can't, it does have a good heart. It has a lovely romance at the center of it with Lake Bell, an actress turned director who made In a World last year. She's really becoming one of my favorite on-screen presences, and she becomes a love interest for John Hamm as J.B. Bernstein. And, of course, we all enjoy John Hamm from the Mad Men series, and he's a very appealing leading man.
Oh, there's a question about him. Do you see him having a career in film after television?
Well, he certainly carries the film. He is a very charismatic presence, and you know, he definitely could be a movie star. And the two young men playing the Indian major league wannabes have both been in films as well. Suraj Sharma, who plays one of them, was Pi in Life of Pi, so we've seen him before on screen.
Oh, yeah.
And the other actor, whose name right now is escaping me, was the elder brother in Slumdog Millionaire. So we've seen both of them, and they're both good actors.
So you're not as crazy about this one?
I'm not, but it definitely has something going for it. So, you know, it's not a bad film to see for the weekend.
Now the fun begins. We're going to take a break here, Chris, on Midday Friday with Christopher Llewellyn Reed, and because we have to ask for some support for our spring pledge drive again. But when we get back, we're going to talk about Godzilla, the new Godzilla film, and survey 60 years of Godzilla. And we'd like to hear from our listeners if you want to talk about Godzilla when we get back with Christopher Llewellyn Reed, who has seen the new movie. And I've seen the trailer and some clips from it. I'm sure I'm going to end up in the theater seeing the new Godzilla film. So we'll take a little break here, folks, and come back for more of Midday Friday. Our conversation will continue in just a moment. First, this quick break, as I said, as we try to raise the money it takes to bring you the news and talk programming you hear on WYPR, please call 410-235-1395.
That's 410-235-1395, 410-235-1395, or make your pledge online at WYPR.org. Andy Bienstock joining Dan Rodericks on this Friday afternoon. Fridays is always on Midday, a little bit different. Sometimes a local news roundup, sometimes a local arts roundup. A little bit different, and a parade of guests coming in and out through the day.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that, something newsy, something soft, something from the arts page. That's what we're doing now. And then we have Chris Reed coming in, Christopher Llewellyn Reed, one of our two Midday film critics. And he's been to see the new Godzilla film. And we're going to talk about that, but also Godzilla through the ages, Godzilla. There's 60 years of Godzilla out there, and Chris knows all about that, so we'll be talking about it this hour.
The first one is still my favorite.
The original, yeah.
With Raymond Burr.
With Raymond Burr, who plays a journalist, right? He's there covering the terror that is Godzilla,
and
Gojira.
As I understand it, he was not in the original Japanese film, and
that's
they just
edited
him in.
To
appeal to American audience. Who knew that Raymond Burr would appeal to American audiences? He wouldn't be my first choice. But
Perry Mason. Yeah. Well, Chris mentions to me that there's a digital version of the original that's making the rounds of theaters throughout the country and coming to the Charles, I think, in a week or two. So you'll be, if you want to see it, the new digital version of it, the original, it'll be at the Charles. In the meantime, we need to ask for your help here at WYPR, 410-235-1395, a special call out to our Midday listeners to support WYPR and our program.
Muto, massive unidentified terrestrial organism. It is, however, no longer terrestrial, it is airborne. Now, the world still thinks this was an earthquake, and it would be preferable that that remain so. Before we lost sight of it, it was headed east across the Pacific and had emitted enough EMP disruption to create havoc with our radar and satellite feeds and reduce us, for the moment, to a strictly visual pursuit. I emphasize for the moment, because we will get on our game and we will find this thing. It is imperative that we do so.
And that wasn't the Secretary of State from Lincoln. That's actually an excerpt from the new Godzilla movie, a reboot of the now 60-year-old franchise Godzilla. And you know who I'm referring to there, right?
David Strathairn.
David, how did you pronounce his last name?
It's either Strathairn or Strathairn.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The last time I saw him, he was playing the Secretary of State to Lincoln in the Spielberg film. But here he is, you know, issuing a warning about Godzilla in the new film.
Yeah, he's on an aircraft carrier, and he's actually talking about one of the other monsters in the film called a Muto.
A Muto.
And part of my issues with this new film, which we can talk about in a moment after we go through the canon, is that there are all of these monsters other than Godzilla, which take up screen time. And I just really wanted to see Godzilla and humanity
rising
against him.
Okay. Well, first of all, what brought this about? I remember in the 90s there was a Godzilla revival, another Godzilla movie. I mean, is this just a franchise you can keep going back to? People like to see big dragons coming out of the ocean and destroying cities.
Well, starting in 1954, it has been a series of now 28 Japanese films produced by Toho Studios that has, had a really kind of devoted fan base. It's gone from being the series that was originally about sort of humanity's nuclear hubris, in particular American misuse of nuclear power, because the first Godzilla had supposedly been mutated or awoken by our nuclear testing on the Bikini Atoll.
Right. Unleashed the monster.
We unleashed the monster, mm-hmm. Gojira, as yep. it's pronounced in Japanese. And then it sort of went through a phase later where, Godzilla would sometimes be humanity's savior, fighting monsters who were attacking cities. And instead of destroying Tokyo, he might be defending Tokyo. He did battle with King Kong. He did battle with a giant moth by the name of Mothra, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So the series has morphed and changed.
The moth thing I never got. But I laugh a little bit. Well, you laugh a little bit when you see these old movies.
Absolutely.
Listen, Chris, I wanted to interject something here. I would like to hear from our listeners on Godzilla. You can say anything you want about it. Keen observation, or just a funny moment from watching Godzilla films over the year, if you're a real fanboy or fangirl of Godzilla, because we have two tickets to give away to Cinema Sundays at the Charles Theater. And they're going to go to the first person who calls in with a comment about Godzilla, okay? 410-662-8780. Just time out to say that this week there's a screening of Palo Alto, a movie based on the short stories of Hollywood polymath James Franco, I guess he is a polymath. And you're hosting this one?
I am. I'm hosting this Sunday screening.
Excellent. It's at 10:30 this Sunday.
It's a good film.
These are two tickets to this week's Cinema Sunday at Charles Theater. But please call in with a comment about any of the Godzilla films, any observation you'd like to make about them. Now, so I've got to ask you this. Now, you look at these old movies, and I realize films from the 50s, the monster movies, the sci-fi films, they're all to us now, looking back 60 years, they look kind of campy and silly and pretty bad, right? You like to sit around and make jokes about them. Some people do. Is there in the new film at all any kind of a pain to that campiness from the old movies at all that you'd recognize?
That's an excellent question. And I have to say that part of the problem with this film is that it is extremely self-serious. So if you're looking for any campiness, even though the 1998 Godzilla was excoriated by fans and critics alike, you'd have to go back to that film in order to see some of that level of campiness. This new film, which I think will be appealing to fans, and it's already appealing to some critics, is an extremely serious film. There's very little in the way of humor.
Well, I could go for that. Were you up for that? What did you want? Well, what were you expecting?
Well, I was expecting a film that told a compelling story with interesting human characters, and instead I got a CGI monster battle fest where you had Godzilla, who appears after about an hour for no real reason. The film spends an hour explaining the arrival of the Mutos, as we heard David Strathairn say, the massive unidentified terrestrial objects. And then it turns out that Godzilla's arrival is to sort of recalibrate, restore order to the universe, and to fight these Mutos, who have themselves come about because of human error and greed and perhaps...
So wait, he's restoring order by destroying the Mutos cities?
He ends up destroying cities in the process, but Godzilla's goal in this film is not to destroy. It is to fight the monsters. And any destruction that Godzilla wreaks is kind of unintentional.
So it's like Rocky.
It is in a way.
But Rocky had compelling characters, actually. You don't have enough good human characters. Is that the problem?
No. And okay. Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who was not bad in Anna Karenina and has been a lead in some other action films, I feel can't really carry the movie. The film does have early on scenes with Bryan Cranston and Juliette Binoche, both of whom bring good gravitas and talent to the proceedings, but the film shifts gears and we end up kind of watching Aaron Taylor-Johnson who I don't think can carry the film.
What, shriek a lot?
No, he actually does no shrieking. He's a bomb disposal expert. He is part of the best scene in the film, which is a halo jump out of a plane onto San Francisco.
I saw that. There's a clip of that with the director. By the way, the director's name is...
Gareth Edwards, who made a wonderful, much better monster movie in 2010 called Monsters.
Monsters, yeah. The New York Times had a video of him narrating how that scene was made. That jump that you're talking about.
The halo jump.
It's quite good.
And it's the best scene in the film.
He says it's my favorite scene in the film.
Oh, yeah. It is visually compelling, and it has great music in it by Ligeti.
Please join us here in the next few minutes talking about Godzilla. We'll take Kay's call. Kay, you'll get the tickets to the Cinema Sundays at the Charles Theater. Thanks for calling in, Kay.
Yes.
What did you want to say about Godzilla?
What I want to say about Godzilla is I love the Godzilla movies. I especially like Godzilla when Mothra, because they had the two little girls that would sing, and then the moth would come up. Godzilla would tear up the Tokyo, but there was never any blood or gore as a kid, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
Because you knew by the next Godzilla movie, Tokyo would be rebuilt, and he'll do it all over again.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Hey, Kay, stay on the line and talk to our producer in the control room, and we'll get this ticket to you. We have to do this quickly, too. Or maybe, I think you can just pick these up on Sunday at Cinema Sundays.
Okay.
Yeah. At the Charles Theater.
Okay.
Here's Dan in Greenbelt with a comment about Godzilla as well. Thanks for calling, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me. Sure. I just wanted to say that I always found the Godzilla movies to be the perfect expression of catharsis because, you know, we as people really enjoy disaster movies. And as the Godzilla series evolved, the expression through proxy of that catharsis really showed through.
Yeah, I can't agree more. And I love, you know, sort of apocalyptic movies, post-apocalyptic movies of humanity having to rebuild. And I find those very cathartic. Unfortunately, for me, since there were no human characters for me to relate to in this film, it was just sort of it was an excruciating experience.
And what's an example of a film where you got that? Well, Transformers?
I was mentioning to you just a moment ago, as vapid as some of the characters are in the movie Cloverfield, that for me was a much more compelling monster movie. That was from 2008 from producer J.J. Abrams. And a film like that actually worked for me. And then, you know, all of the zombie films that we've seen over the last 15, 20 years, the good ones like 28 Days Later, those I find very cathartic.
Let's take another call. Curtis in Baltimore. You're on Midday. Chris Reed here. Hi.
Hey, hi. I appreciate you taking my call. I was wondering, what is behind the name of Godzilla? God is right there in the name, so I'm just wondering if there's more to it. And then I hear the movie itself has some, you know, like you were just saying, the Mutos and whatnot has some other implications of meaning.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. You know, Godzilla is, of course, not the original name of the monster. It's Gojira in Japanese. And Godzilla is a pretty straightforward 1950s transliteration from the Japanese characters of the name. The J was often transliterated as a Z, and the Ra was often transliterated as a La. So it's almost by coincidence that the name ends up having God in it in English. Not that that can't then be used by a clever filmmaker to make Godzilla like a god. And in interviews, Gareth Edwards has said that his Godzilla is supposed to be somewhat godlike. I just wish it were supported by the film I saw. It was very interesting for me to read that in an interview with him, but I didn't see that on the screen.
In the screen. Yeah. Interesting. Another question for you. Raymond Burr. Raymond Burr shows up in a remake of the original Japanese film, right?
In 1956, a Hollywood studio released the original 1954 film with additional scenes added on with Raymond Burr playing Steve Martin, an American journalist. And then, because they didn't feel like just redubbing the whole film. So they added these scenes, which are actually, for the time, integrated very well into the original film. It's a somewhat cheesy device, but if you didn't know that they'd done this, you wouldn't necessarily guess that.
A question from one of our listeners, Stephen, wants to know, did that role make Raymond Burr a good guy and prepare him for the Perry Mason role on TV? Because up until then, Raymond Burr was one of the great menacing villains of 40s and 50s film noir in Desperate Raw Deal, for instance.
Or Rear Window. Opposite James Stewart. Yeah. I think it did in some ways. I mean, I'm not a huge Raymond Burr aficionado, but I would certainly believe that that helped pave the way. interesting little bit of trivia, all of the scenes in the 1956 Godzilla King of the Monsters American version with Raymond Burr were shot in a single 24-hour period.
Right.
So
low budget, do it fast.
Low budget, do it fast.
Right. We have a clip from the film to listen to?
Yes.
Another one?
Yeah, so this is from the 1956 American redubbed version of Godzilla, where Raymond Burr, Steve Martin, is narrating the opening of the film. This is something that you don't see in the 54 version, and he's explaining what has happened as we see images of a ruined Tokyo.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown, an unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world. There were once many people here who could have told of what they saw. Now there are only a few. My name is Steve Martin. I'm a foreign correspondent for United World News. I was headed for an assignment in Cairo when I stopped off in Tokyo for a social call. But it turned out to be a visit to the living hell of another world.
So much for that social call in Tokyo. I remember liking this film. I missed a whole bunch of these others, all these 28 other
Haven't seen every single one of the...
No, but I've seen. I know that they come on from time to time.
Yeah, and
you can catch them.
They're fun to watch. It's particularly fun to see how the Godzilla latex suit changed.
Yeah.
Because as he started fighting other monsters, they slimmed him down because the actor inside the suit needed to be able to put... I mean, he would literally put the other monsters in wrestle holds and half Nelsons.
That's right.
So they had to slim the suit down.
Now, this Godzilla, the 2014 Godzilla, looks pretty kind of paunchy, actually, a little bit middle-aged, would you say? Or
yes, he does. And that was something I read in the reviews as well, which I found amusing.
Oh, really? Yeah, other people notice that? I just saw it from the... This is a big Godzilla.
It's a big Godzilla.
The earlier Godzillas, you know, they were a little bit higher than high tension wise.
It's supposed to be 30 stories tall. Was the original Godzilla.
I don't know about
but
that.
But now he's grown much, much higher.
Right, right. So, Chris, you like it?
The new Godzilla?
No, you don't.
I do not like it.
You called it a leviathan.
A lumbering,
ludicrous leviathan, but fanboys will probably dig it.
That is what I tweeted.
You can read Christopher Llewellyn Reed's reviews of these films, his comments about them, by looking on my Facebook page as well as finding our tweets, because our tweets provide links to all of those. So, Chris, thanks very much for being here today.
Thanks, Dan. It was fun.
And you can catch Chris Sunday at Cinema Sundays at the Charles Theater for a screening of Palo Alto. That's at 10:30 on this Sunday. So thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Dan.
1 hour of Midday Friday is finished. We have another hour coming up for you in just a moment. But first, another quick reminder about how you can become a supporter of Your Public Radio during our spring membership campaign. Andy Beanstalk, what's the number to call?
Dan, the number to call is 410-235-1395. That's 410-235-1395. Or make your pledge online at wypr.org. A few wonderful thank you gifts for you during this membership campaign. A little while ago, Dan was talking about the coffee mug and waking up in the morning, turning the radio on, first thing in the morning, listening to WYPR and having your coffee. And I do that all the time, but during the pledge drive, I do it real early in the morning. And we always say you learn something new when you listen to WYPR. So at about, it was like a 3:45 this morning.
Oh, BBC.
I'm sitting in the kitchen listening to the BBC, and it was a science segment, and they were talking about skeletal structures. And I'm saying...
Skeletal.
And I'm like, oh, that's skeletal.
Do they really say skeletal?
They said skeletal.
And
the other one, they were talking about... climate change affecting the, what do they call it? The glaciers. The glaciers.
No kidding.
The glaciers.
Wow.
Like a glacier.
I knew they said aluminium.
Aluminium.
That I've heard. And there's some other, British pronunciations that are enjoyable.
Skeletal and glaciers.
Yeah. I don't know. I know you folks like to sleep out there, but if you're having a sleepless moment or you get up really early for some reason, the BBC overnight on WYPR is just great. I've listened to so many amusing interviews. One about human hair why men have hair, more hair than women. It was like a history of human hair. It went on for about 10 minutes, 12 minutes. I must say it was really interesting.
And if you ever think Dan is tough on his guests, you should hear some of those.
Yeah, they're good.
There was an interview this morning with someone from Mugabe's government, and he was getting no peace. That presenter was challenging every word the man said.
Yeah, they're tenacious.
And your pledge makes possible the BBC at 12 o'clock midnight, just as it makes possible midday at 12 o'clock noon. Noon and midnight, we rely on your generosity to bring you these great programs. We're relying on you right now. 410-235-1395 or WIPR.org.
We're hearing that lots of folks are making their membership contributions online this time at WIPR. It's quick and easy if you want to do it that way. Just go to WIPR.org. More of your contribution will go to support programming. That's the main thing here. That's the reason we're here. Programming on WIPR, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Maryland Morning, Midday, The Signal, and then all the weekend programming that I know on Friday you even start looking forward to, the weekend on WIPR. Please show your support now. Go online at WIPR.org or just call us. Do it the old-fashioned way with the telephone. Say hello to our volunteers, 410-235-1395.
Support for WIPR comes from our members, thank you, and from Chizuk Emunah Congregation and its Love to Learn Festival on May 18th, featuring 25 mini-talks on diverse subjects such as ballroom dancing, climate change, Jewish scholarship, and history. Learn more at chizukamuno.org. Chizuk Emunah, where ideas happen. Support also comes from Celtic Woman, the Emerald Tour. This all-new stage production celebrates Ireland and Celtic heritage through traditional Irish anthems, pop standards, and original music. Celtic Woman, live May 27th at the Hippodrome Theater. For tickets and information, BroadwayAcrossAmerica.com. This is your public radio, member-supported 88.1, WIPR and WIPR HD1 Baltimore, WIPF Frederick, WIPO Ocean City, and online, we're at WIPR.org. Your NPR news station, made possible by you and your support. We're asking for your support this afternoon during Midday with Dan Rodericks. Please take a few minutes and talk to one of our volunteers at 410-235-1395. That's 410-235-1395. Maybe you're online right now. You can make your pledge securely online at our website. That's WIPR.org.
Having won the Kentucky Derby, California Chrome has the potential to become the first horse to win racing's Triple Crown since 1978. But first, of course, Chrome will need to win tomorrow's running of the Preakness Stakes at Pimlico Racecourse, in which he faces a fresh field of competitors after a day of heavy rain. The unlikely candidate for horse racing's highest honor has Maryland ties. Today, we talk with the breeders of California Chrome's Dam, that's equine for mother, and hear about the lauded horse's humble beginnings. Also, if you're thinking about getting in on the action, handicapper Andrew Beyer joins us to give his rundown of the big race. All that coming up on Midday Friday after the news.